From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Friday, July the 17th, 2020, and we have an interesting show lined up for you today. I do believe we're going to be speaking in the first hour here with three folks on the subject of a possible link between exposure to cyanobacteria of the sort that is a big worry connected with some of the blue-green algae blooms we get in Vermont lakes in the summertime, and a possible link between exposure to that cyanobacteria and ALS, popularly known as Lou Gehrig's disease, a terrible neurological disease, progressive disease that generally ends in death, and it is a really difficult thing. And we want to bring into our discussion here Dr. Elijah Stommel. He is with the Dartmouth Medical School, and also he's a professor there and also works at the Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. He's a neurologist. And Dr. Stommel, good morning. Thank you so much for taking some time to join us today.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
We also have with us Sarah Vose. She's a toxicologist with the Vermont Department of Health. And Sarah, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Good morning.
And we have the James Ellers is with us. James brought this topic to my attention. He's an activist on several environmental issues, mainly having to do with the water quality, the streams and lakes in Vermont, and especially the Lake Champlain watershed. He's with Lake Champlain International. And James, thank you for joining us this morning as well.
Thank you, Dave, and good morning, Dr. Vose and Dr. Stommel.
let me start with you, Dr. Stommel. I understand that you have been researching a possible link between cyanobacteria exposure and ALS. First off, those initials, I meant to look just before we got on the air here. There's a long word that starts with A and then it's lateral sclerosis. Help me out here.
Yeah, so ALS is otherwise called amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. It's also called motor neuron disease, also referred to as Lou Gehrig's disease, the famous baseball player. It's a disease that involves both the upper motor neurons in your cerebral cortex and the lower motor neurons that are in your spinal cord. And so patients generally develop a combination of spasticity, and that can be in the voice or in the limbs. And on top of that, they will develop atrophy and weakness, and will have often problems swallowing and speaking and breathing eventually. It's a devastating disease. There's no cure for it. About 10% is inherited, where you actually see it from one generation to the next. And it probably in everybody has some genetic predisposition, everybody who develops the disease. And on top of that, as like with cancer, there probably are environmental insults that build up over time, and eventually these motor neurons start to die off.
And you have been looking into this for some time, especially the, as you put it, environmental insults, and doing some research on this. What have you found to date?
Well, we've had a lot of different projects going on. Our own lab here at Dartmouth has been looking at environmental influences on ALS, and we have been very interested in cyanotoxins. We have a big team of researchers, including an epidemiologist, a toxicologist, Angeline Andrew. We have a world-famous neurologist working with us, Walter Bradley. We have Paul Cox's lab out in Wyoming. We have Rook Tandon from UVM, John DeWitt from UVM, and I have some very talented lab partners, including Tanya Butt, Maeve Tischbein, and we even have a remote sensing expert, Nathan Torbick, and a geographer, Bart Guetti, and a Dartmouth faculty member, Zun Shi, who does a lot of GIS mapping. So it's a big team, and I'm not even mentioning everybody on the team, all of which have their own expertise. As a neurologist, I couldn't possibly do all this type of research on my own.
It does take a number of kind of a blending of a number of specialties. And in the research that you have looked at, I understand there was a lake near near Lebanon, maybe in Lebanon. I don't remember exactly where it is over there, but somewhere in that neck of the woods of New Hampshire, which you were focusing on in particular. Is that right?
Yes, that was quite a long time ago now, 2008. And I had a lot of eager medical students who wanted a project to work on. And so I had them map out our database of ALS patients that we have here at Dartmouth. And we found some clustering around Lake Muskoma. We made some calculations, and it looked like there was about a 25 times higher rate of ALS around this lake than other, you know, sort of the background level. And I know that cluster is a dirty word to epidemiologists, there was an abundance of ALS around this lake. And so we started thinking about it, and I talked to some lake experts, some limnologists, one in particular, Jim Haney over at UNH, and he said, oh, yeah, that lake has a long history of cyanobacterial blooms. And if you go back to the literature of the 1940s and 1950s in Guam, the island in the Pacific where the Americans had military bases back in the 1940s, the mid-1940s, and since then, there was a very high rate of ALS there, about 200 times higher than the rest of the world. Also an Alzheimer's-like picture and also a Parkinson's-like picture. It was called ALS-Parkinson's Dementia Complex. And over the years, pretty well shown at this point that the cyanobacterial toxin BMAA was probably responsible for that high rate on that island. And the same chemical BMAA and the same cyanobacteria that were found in Guam were found in Lake Muskoma. So we found that to be an interesting fact, and we've been sort of working on that ever since.
And now we have a situation, of course, in Vermont where there's a lot of focus on Lake Champlain, and we do have blue-green algae blooms with cyanobacteria in Lake Champlain. Are we seeing, are we expecting the same sort of effect there?
Well, we have found clusters of ALS in Vermont near Lake Champlain and near Shelburne Pond. And we've been trying to get as many of the cases in Vermont as we possibly can, and that's our affiliation with UVM and Dr. Tandon. I actually have a patient who lived on Shelburne Point who developed ALS, and his workman, who was a gardener and took care of the grounds there, came down with ALS within a couple of years of him. Found that to be an interesting observation.
Wow.
It doesn't mean anything in itself, but they both were right on the lake and were they had hobbies that involved going out on the lake and fishing, that kind of thing. So, it's just an interesting fact. I've found other conjugal couples, so people who live in the same house together come down with ALS at the same time. So those are very interesting and suggest that there might be some environmental influence. And I won't overestimate the importance of cyanobacteria because there are many other toxins that have been linked to ALS, and that includes a variety of pesticides, persistent organic pollutants, which are things that are man-made. Air pollution may be an issue, and PCBs, and heavy metals. We've been looking at heavy metals and have found higher levels of methylmercury in ALS patients than controls. Interestingly, methylmercury has a sort of a positive effect on the toxicity of BMAA. So if you have those two toxins together, they're more toxic than one or the other alone in cell culture. So that's of interest.
I'm wondering if, since you've looked at sort of different cases of ALS, clusters, let's take Guam and Lake Muskoma, which are on opposite sides of the world. Were there other things in common aside from cyanobacteria, items from the list you just named, for instance, that those two sites had in common?
The pathology of ALS in Guam is slightly different than the pathology in the rest of the world, but the genetics may play into that as well. There are other toxins that have been linked to the plant that the cyanobacteria live in, and they may be synergistic with the cyanotoxins, or may in themselves be very toxic to neurons. So there are some studies that have been done. There's a guy named Peter Spencer who's been looking at some of the other toxins in Guam that might be related to neurodegeneration.
I want to bring in Sarah Vose, toxicologist with the Vermont Department of Health. But before I do, one more question for you, Doctor, to sort of set up our conversation with Sarah Vose. You actually asked the state of Vermont, from what I understand, and actually saw letters to about this. You asked the state of Vermont to create an ALS registry, to better enable you to map where cases were happening around the state. And why did you do that? And give us your version of what happened.
Well, there is a national registry, but it's not mandatory. The only state in the country that has a mandatory registry is Massachusetts. And that was set up back around 2008. After the governor of Massachusetts, Salucci was his last name, came down with ALS and died. Mandatory registries are very, very helpful for epidemiologists and anybody studying a disease. And of course, they have them for cancer, they have them for infectious diseases, and all cases are reported. It's mandatory. And one of the main reasons the state of Vermont did not want to set up a registry was that it would cost money. And they also mentioned the fact that ALS was a rare disease. Well, if you're my age, or I suspect you're about the same age I am, but I don't know. If you're my age, the chances of getting ALS, if you're male and my age, is about 1 in 300. And that doesn't sound very rare. The other issue is that there is research being done, and there is some very solid basic research that has been done showing that these cyanotoxins, especially BMAA, is directly linked to Alzheimer's disease and probably Parkinson's disease. And those are not trivial diseases either, and they're quite prevalent. So I would argue that other than the money factor, having a mandatory registry for ALS would be very useful. And I think it, in fact, could probably be piggybacked onto the infectious disease or cancer registries. And it could be housed at a place like UVM or Dartmouth, where they already have epidemiologists, and probably could be done for a substantially lower amount of money than has been projected. And I've tried to do the same thing in New Hampshire and was basically shot down for the same reason.
Let me go to Sarah Vose, the toxicologist with the Vermont Health Department. And Dr. Vose, by the way, thanks again for joining us this morning. I wanted to ask you, first off, the science. You've just heard Dr. Stommel talking about. Do you concur with his general view of the situation and the possible links, causalities, et cetera?
Yeah, hi. Good morning, Dave, and good morning, everyone. So the health department is really glad that this research is happening because, as Dr. Stommel spoke about, 90% of ALS cases do not have a known cause. So it is really important that researchers continue this work to try to understand the various environmental factors that may contribute to someone's risk. The health department is concerned about cyanobacteria. You know, again, as Dr. Stommel mentioned, he talked about BMAA. There are some other more common toxins that cyanobacteria produce. These are frequently measured in Lake Champlain and in our other lakes. We don't currently have the capacity to analyze BMAA, so we haven't really seen data about the prevalence of BMAA. But nonetheless, we encourage all Vermonters to avoid cyanobacteria blooms because we know that cyanobacteria can cause illnesses in people. Some of them can be quite severe. We've seen some dog deaths from some other types of neurotoxic toxins. So we have a video on our website that it's a 3-minute video, and it helps people identify or helps them learn how to identify cyanobacteria, because the most important thing that people can do is to be able to go to a beach and be able to tell for themselves and their family, you know, is this a regular plant material? Is this algae? Is this pollen? Or is it cyanobacteria? Because those are three very different things. So we do encourage everyone to avoid cyanobacteria. As far as the connection between ALS and cyanobacteria, you know, again, it's an active area of research, and we do read all the papers that are published, but cyanobacteria is not a known risk factor for ALS right now. The cluster studies that have been published are really spatial analysis studies. Dr. Stommel mentioned there are other reasons that people may develop ALS. There are other risk factors, and it's really important from an epidemiology perspective that those other reasons for developing ALS be taken into account into these studies.
Sure. And in terms of creating a registry of ALS cases around the state, which is, I think, was the goal of Dr. Stommel's letter, the health department decided against that. And I think I read the letter from Dr. Levine, the health commissioner, and he did cite the cost. He cited also just the relative rarity of ALS cases versus, say, a disease for which the state does have a registry, and that's cancer. Of course, there are many different types of cancer. Let me ask Sarah Vos if you could tell us, are there any other sort of registry? There's a cancer registry. Are there any other registries like it in Vermont looking at other types of health problems?
Yeah. There's no question when you're looking at a disease that may have environmental causes, to have a registry would provide the scientists with the best information to be able to study the prevalence and cause of the disease. So that's true for ALS. It's also true for all the other neurodegenerative diseases. There are hundreds of other diseases that occur in people that may have environmental causes that we don't have a registry for. So the current Vermont registry is really centered around things that are communicable, so diseases that can pass very quickly from one person to another. And the obvious reason behind requiring reporting within 24 hours is so that the health department can work to limit the spread of those communicable diseases.
Sure, and obviously a big one right now is COVID-19, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
I mean, the health department tracks all of the cases of COVID-19 in Vermont, and obviously that is extremely communicable, unfortunately. And so I get that in the case of a communicable disease. Now, in the case of something like cancer or ALS, less to anybody's knowledge, less immediately communicable, but as you were saying, Dr. Vos, that it sounds like that in an ideal world, you probably would have a registry for something like ALS and maybe some other diseases as well. It's just really a matter of kind of prioritizing resources, et cetera. Is that what I have in? I mean, am I on the right track there?
Yeah, and I'll really defer to the letter that Dr. Levine sent because it really outlines the health department's response that it's, you know, well, we agree scientifically from a research perspective it would be fantastic, but Dr. Levine outlines the reasons why it's not possible.
Okay, I want to go to some of the reasons. Maybe you could talk about them for our listeners. But first, let's go to a listener who's calling in. Let's go to Jennifer from South Burlington. Good morning, Jennifer.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to share that I am impacted by this issue because a member of my family has serious neurodegenerative disease, and there's a number of issues that the health department is not taking adequate action on that I think it doesn't make sense to call neurodegenerative diseases rare when she's also naming that there's many, many different neurodegenerative diseases with many different toxic causes in our environment. It makes sense for the health department to actually create a registry of all of those neurodegenerative diseases until we get to the bottom of each and every one of them. I'm not sure how the health department can actually justify not taking action on such a serious issue and just simply instructing people to go to the website and look at what cyanobacteria looks like instead of dealing with and addressing the causes in our in the environment. It seems to me that that would be better for the health of the state. In my family's case, the member of our family who has a serious neurological condition, we may never know the cause, but there's multiple things in the environment in Vermont that the health department is not taking seriously and addressing as seriously as they could.
Jennifer, first off, I'm very sorry for your situation and your family member's situation there. That's terrible. But I want to ask you, government agencies like a health department or any other government agency are operating with limited resources and is always pressure to, you know, keep taxes down and this sort of thing. But I've watched the budget process at the State House as a longtime reporter there, Associated Press, and earlier in my career. And it's tough. You know, there are a lot of competing demands for state funding. What do you think about that when you try to figure out where this would fit in terms of, it sounds like you're talking about a major increase in funding, basically, for the health department to do a lot more of this research et cetera. So tell us a little bit about that and how you would weigh that against all the other competing demands.
It doesn't sound to me that the health department is taking into consideration the cost of the illness itself to our community and to my family, which in the case of my family is hundreds of thousands of dollars. I feel like a community investment to preventing these issues makes a lot of sense because the cost in terms of human life is astronomical. The cost in terms of people being able to productively engage in our economy in other ways, when I think about the situation in my family, which I won't disclose because it's not mine to do so, but we have many toxins in our environment. For instance, a number of a citizen group has written a letter to the health department last November asking for information about what the health department plans to do about the health impacts of the F-35 basing, which also include the PFAS chemicals in our water supply now, which are forever toxic cancer-causing chemicals. So the fact that we actually have a health department in our state that's not taking action on behalf of the health of people in our state, and that all of us are out here wondering why we're coming on with these mysterious diseases, everything from autism to Alzheimer's to Parkinson's to multiple other diseases, and each individual, human person may have different types of vulnerabilities systemically based on, you know, a lot of different variables. And so these diseases may manifest differently for each person, but you have a rampant amount of neurological conditions in our society. And then what the health department does, unfortunately, is, you know, not enough. And so, you know, people are paid to do not enough for the people. It doesn't actually make any sense what's happening right now. And there does need to be a registry, in my opinion. And I think it's criminal that people think that budgeting is an issue when they are not taking into consideration and ought to do a study of the actual cost to those of us living with these diseases in our community and in our family.
Jennifer, a tough critique, eloquently put. I'm going to ask Sarah Vose and perhaps Dr. Stommel, James Ehlers, to address it after the break. We got to go to some CBS News here at the bottom of the hour. We'll be back and continue our conversation in just a few minutes.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Well, that was a tough critique right there before the break from Jennifer in South Burlington, who called in and talked about a family member of hers suffering from a neurological disease and hundreds of thousands of dollars of cost to that family. And she clearly thinks that the state needs to do a lot more in terms of research and battling these situations and trying to minimize their presence in society. And I really would feel neglectful if I didn't give you a chance, Sarah Vose, a toxicologist with the health department. I don't mean to necessarily put you on the spot, but I just, if you would like to respond to some of what Jennifer had to say, you have the floor.
Yeah, and that is a tough situation. You know, we appreciate hearing that feedback. I will make sure that that gets passed around the health department for others to hear as well. You know, if it does turn out after several years of more research that the link is proven between cyanobacteria and ALS, you know, our advice right now to all Vermonters is to avoid cyanobacteria. So, you know, in a sense, it may not matter if we're saying that to protect against toxins that may cause other health symptoms or may cause neurodegenerative issues, but the advice to Vermonters is to avoid cyanobacteria at all costs.
I want to get something, maybe some confusion in my own mind cleared up here, because you said something earlier, I think, about cyanobacteria being something different from blue-green algae. And I sort of was under the impression that cyanobacteria was kind of a feature of blue-green algae. Straighten me out here.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that, actually. So cyanobacteria are bacteria, and they were misnamed as blue-green algae. So algae is actually a different type of cell. The word cyanobacteria is a bit hard to grasp for people. So the name blue-green algae just stuck because it's easier to remember and it is easy to relate to what you see because it does look a bit like algae and it is blue-green. But the proper name for it is cyanobacteria. An algae is a plant material. You can often differentiate between algae and cyanobacteria by using a stick. If you can pick up the material floating on the surface or just under the surface with a stick, that's probably green algae, which is a plant material, and it's not cyanobacteria.
Okay. I don't know if I want to get close enough to this stuff to pick it up with a stick, but that's another story. Let me ask Dr. Stommel something along the lines, you know, about what, also maybe to respond to what Jennifer had to say before the break there. You know, I was talking to Jennifer a little bit about just the constraint on resources, that the health department doesn't have an infinite amount of money to spend or staff to put after various research projects, et cetera. Where do you kind of strike the balance here?
Yeah, well, I appreciate the financial constraints. I mean, we all have those. And I also appreciate the fact that if you develop a bad neurodegenerative disease, that the financial impact on you and your family is tremendous. The fact that Massachusetts was able to fund a mandatory ALS registry simply reflects the fact that because the governor had it and died of it, they set it up in his honor. So they were able to find the money. The registry in Massachusetts, to my understanding, cost about $200,000 to start, and they have one person, and I think one aide, who continue to run it. Alicia Frazier is the present director of the Massachusetts Registry. I think that if you do take into consideration all the neurodegenerative diseases that are out there, Jennifer's point is well taken, that it's a much larger number of patients than just those affected with ALS. I do have access to the Mass Registry data now, and we're planning to do some studies there. We can look back in time by using special techniques and companies that solicit to mail out orders, and there's one company called LexisNexis, and we can go back about 30 years and see where everybody has lived over a period of 30 years, and then we can map out all the toxins in a particular geographic location. In this case, it would be Massachusetts, and we can map out all the toxins that we want to, that we know of, and it's quite an extensive job, but you can do that. And then you can do some machine learning where you can, artificial intelligence, where you can have a computer try to make associations with where people have lived and what they've been exposed to. And, of course, we're including cyanobacteria toxins in that equation. And it may be that there is some kind of synergy between multiple toxins over time. And it may be that some of these toxins work at a very young age, as early as in utero. And there's some Swedish data to suggest that in utero exposure may be important. The other issue I just bring up is that avoiding exposures can be very difficult. You can not go swimming in a lake that has cyanobacterial blooms in it and prevent yourself from getting an acute or chronic exposure. But what about the aerosol that comes off of these lakes and water bodies, or even oceans for that matter? People do get sick from the aerosol of a number of microorganisms. And we have found cyanobacteria in the lungs of patients. And we're presently doing a study with the University of Vermont where we're taking postmortem tissue and looking at the lungs and then at the brains of the same patients and looking at the degree of cyanobacteria in the lungs and comparing that to the amount of neurodegeneration in the brain. We don't have all the data back yet.
Speaking of postmortem, I wonder, I was speaking earlier this week with Dr. John Matthew of the Health Center in Plainfield. He was involved in a study of what appeared to be a cluster of ALS cases in Plainfield several years ago now. It may have been close to 20 years ago. I don't know the dates exactly, but and he said that cyanobacteria just kind of wasn't on the radar screen back then when they were investigating this high number of cases. You know, again, a significantly higher number than one would expect from the just general background population in a small rural area. And had you ever heard about that Plainfield cluster?
Yes.
Has anything ever come of that?
I have data on that, and I think it probably is a cluster. And it did occur, maybe 15, 20 years ago over a period of many years. is an agricultural area. There's a lot of pesticides used in those areas. Pesticides may be important. One of the toxins that cyanobacteria make, it's an acute, at least it's thought to be an acute toxin, is called antitoxin AS. And that is the equivalent of an organophosphate pesticide, except that it's 2,000 times more potent than the typical organophosphate pesticides that are put on farm fields. That's pretty amazing. And that's one of the toxins that will kill a domestic animal like a dog in very short order if they drink enough of it from a water source. But yeah. Nobody knows what these very potent toxins do over a period of 20, 30 years. They may have effects similar to pesticides. And pesticides have been very strongly linked to Parkinson's disease. Also, cyanobacteria are found in fertilizers, manure. And a lot of manure is spread over farm fields, as you know. And when that dries up, there's a lot of dust. If you've ever seen a tractor going through a farm field, and we're actually looking at that now, not specifically in Plainfield, but in some other areas.
I see. There. Okay. Let me bring in James Ellers, because James, I wanted to ask you, I understand there's been some discussion about these issues in the legislature just this past session, or I guess the continuing session still, but not much action. Give us an update. Where do things stand in the legislature on this?
Sure, Dave. Well, given that the administration, and I'm sympathetic to Dr. Vose. I think she does outstanding work with the limited resources that she's provided by this administration. Given that public health is not a priority for this administration, and was not willing to make a registry a part of its ongoing budget, we decided to go to, and by we, I mean myself and a couple other advocates, to go directly to the people, to the legislature, to mandate the creation of the registry. Because I do believe Dr. Vose is interested in the research, and so we want to give the health department the tools necessary, because as Dr. Stommel pointed out, I'm concerned about the aerosolization issues, because the health department guidance is to avoid cyanobacteria outbreaks, but you can't avoid it when it's in the air, when you live downwind of these massive outbreaks such as we get in St. Albans Bay, Burlington Harbor, Missisquoi Bay. Literally, there's been dozens of them already this year. And even if you shut the windows and you're using air conditioning, there's significant literature on the dispersal of the aerosol through indoor ventilation air conditioning systems. So there's a bill, H-258, House Bill 258. It's in the House Healthcare Committee. Chairman Bill Lippert has the bill. They've had it for 2 years. It's received no action. And some of that is because I've been told that the state really isn't interested in drawing attention to this issue, because they're concerned about the economic impacts to tourism that this could have if people were to find out that cyanobacteria is related to the nutrient pollution that is going on predominantly, particularly in the areas that are impacted the worst, predominantly due to agriculture. So, you know, I was taught as a young boy, it's not what we say, it's what we do. The governor has recently directed some $25 million to industrial dairy, but is unwilling to find $200,000 to support the work of Dr. Vose and her colleagues.
You were talking about there being some reluctance to delve too much into this issue of a possible link between between cyanobacteria and the prevalence of neurological disorders like ALS. And you were saying that some of that reluctance stems from fear about what such a public discussion could do to tourism in the state of Vermont. Is that speculation by you, or do you have something you're basing that on, or tell us?
I've actually even had voicemails littered with four-letter expletives from agency secretaries asking me in not so polite terms if my goal was to destroy the Vermont economy. So you know, when money's involved, people tend to get a little hot-headed. I'm concerned about public health. I know that the professionals at the Vermont Health Department are. Dr. Stommel has dedicated his entire life to it, and frankly, we're all just a little tired of politicians giving lip service to our environment and the health and welfare of Vermont citizens. And I think it's pathetic, actually, that for want of $200,000. People aren't interested. And there's also, there was an editorial some time back by the Lake Champlain Basin Program, which we know is a government-funded organization, also marginalizing those of us who were concerned about the connection between cyanobacteria and all the major neurodegenerative diseases. So, no, this isn't speculation at all, Dave. I wish it was, but...
Okay. Well, Sarah Vos, do you have any thoughts you want to share on this front? I will understand if you're a little more reticent here than James, but I mean, what do you think about? Do you sense there's any pressure coming down, and not so much just from budgetary restraint point of view, but actually from you know, information management, I guess, is another approach to an issue like this.
I have not experienced anything like that, but I do want to point out that the Massachusetts Registry was established in 2002 after they got a grant from the CDC. So In the Vermont Department of Health, most of our work is grant-funded, and we're constantly applying for grants. So if there ever is funding opportunity for, you know, if the CDC broadens this grant opportunity, we would always be willing to write grants in order to get funding for projects like this.
Yeah, and so $200,000 is, I mean, in the context of even the Vermont, obviously the federal budget, but the state of Vermont budget, sounds like a fairly small item that, you know, I've seen fly through the House Appropriations Committee in 30 seconds or less. Of, you know, that size, I mean, and I just wonder, have you or folks from the health department made a request like this for state funding for a study like this, or is there a preference to wait and see whether you might get some grant funding from CDC?
Yeah, I can't answer questions about requests. That's done at a different level than where I work.
Okay.
But, you know, just to reiterate that the work in Massachusetts is grant funded, and, you know, a lot of our priorities at the health department are dictated by the grant funding that we get. So if we were able to get funding, we would be able to prioritize that.
Yep. Dr. Stommel, I get the sense that you follow these issues really with a perspective that's national and international, perhaps, and I'm wondering, what do you know about any interest on the part of, say, the CDC or other federal agencies in funding this kind of research by, say, individual states like Vermont?
There is some interest. There are some individuals at the CDC with whom I have grant funding now to expand the registry, and they're actually working with the state of Massachusetts because they have access to that data, as do I. But I think ultimately, you know, maybe there has to be a mandatory national registry. I think it's too bad that you know, there isn't the funds to pay for this. From a financial standpoint, if you look at what effects cyanobacterial blooms have on the economy in a place like Florida, it's astounding. And if you don't even take in the health issues, which, of course, to me are the most important, but tourism in certain parts of Florida has completely shut down when these blooms are around. And I have heard of people up in places like St. Albans Bay who have been unable to rent their summer cottage because mm-hmm. people don't want to stay there. So you know, from a financial standpoint, we're talking about $200,000 to start a registry, and if you rent a cottage on Lake Champlain, and there are dozens and dozens, hundreds of them along Lake Champlain, if you can't if you can't rent those or you can't live there because of the stench or the aesthetic quality of the water.
That's a problem. Hey, doctor, I hate to do this. I've got to interrupt you because we are just about out of time.
Sure.
I really appreciate you taking this time this morning. I think you're making a really interesting point just about how public health and the economy basically go hand in hand here, and we can't really separate them very easily. So let's go to the top of the hour break for some CBS News. I want to thank Dr. Elijah Stommel of the Dartmouth Medical School and Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, Sarah Vose of the Vermont Health Department, and James Ehlers, environmental advocate, for being my guest this first hour. Fascinating conversation, the three of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
CBS Thank you. News upcoming. We'll be back on the other side.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, and we are going to be talking with Bob Ney, one of our national correspondents, in just a couple of minutes. I do believe he usually checks in with us on Fridays just after the mid-show news break here and fills us in on in a little more detail and a little more nuance, a little more insight than just the headline service you get at the top of the hour. Bob's a very thoughtful guy, and we really enjoy talking with him when he does join us in the a little bit later this hour, actually starting at about quarter after. I believe we're going to be joined by singer Sarah Grace, bass player and music producer Ben Dunham, and very widely regarded actor Luis Guzman, international repute of Mr. Guzman. He happens to live in Vermont. The three of these folks are going to be joining us to talk about the performing arts and how they have been really thrown for a loop, frankly, by the coronavirus crisis and how they are trying to respond. And, you know, musicians will do music and actors will act regardless of what the circumstances are, because this is what they do and what they love. And we'll be talking with these three artists in the latter three quarters of this hour about how they're getting along in this coronavirus era. Meanwhile, the Dave Graham Show welcomes calls from listeners, and we're always glad to have folks call in and tell us what's on your mind. If anybody has any thoughts they'd like to share about that first hour of radio we did this morning, boy, that's a tough nut to crack. That whole issue of cyanobacteria exposure, possible links to ALS, you know, Lou Gehrig's disease, or other neurological disorders. There's just a lot to talk about there. But let's go to a national picture now from Bob Ney, who just joins us on the phone this morning. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Dave.
And how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm hanging in there, just trying to make sense of a few things, but I'll be okay in the long run.
Yeah, you made it to Friday again, so
that's right.
Look that's at right. the bright side. It's been a tough year for everybody, I think, so far, and if you have any brilliant ideas for how people just ought to cope in general, you have the floor.
Well, I actually had a long conversation about that last night There was a young couple. They've been friends of mine. They came in from Colorado, you know. And we talked about actually that very topic. We didn't really talk about the coronavirus and, you know, where we thought everything was going to end up as much as we talked about how you cope with it. And, I mean, I think one of the things, you know, you can't control certain things. And people have opinions and everything, but I think in their own personal lives, they've just got to try to make it as good as they can, you know, at the home level with their loved ones, their friends, and just try to, you know, I hate to say look on the bright side, but try to get past some of this and make things as normal as possible. I mean, that's what we do with my grandkids. We try to make it in an abnormal world right now as normal as we can.
Yeah, yeah, boy, it's an abnormal world, all right. And I think you're right. I mean, I think basically looking on the bright side is always a good idea, but first you kind of have to build your own bright side, it seems, these days.
Exactly.
So that's part of the project. Well, let's go to some of the headlines here. NCAA warns fall sports at risk. Coronavirus data points in wrong direction. I don't know how you play football in this age, or basketball, or any of the other certainly contact sports. And what are you hearing out there?
Well, you know, the NCAA canceled some programs, of course, before, and now everybody's looking into the future here in the fall, which is not that far in the future. And I just think that the warning from the NCAA, you know, with the College Athletic Association, probably is kind of throwing out there, hey, this may not work, is what I think they're basically saying. Try to follow the guidelines, but again, it may not work. So I think this is still an uncertainty. And of course, once you start messing with sports, you really can get people going and agitated, you know, and opinionated on it. But I think it's going to be a tough fall.
Sports, and you know, another area that gets popular in fall, of course, is marching band. All those halftime shows,
sure.
and the instrumentalists who are out there marching around in their figures, and so I mean, you know, forming different pictures on the field and all that great stuff. I just saw somebody sent me a study of what's going on in the music world about this kind of stuff, and. There were pictures of this thing of somebody playing. They had a special bag. This woman had a special bag over her clarinet. And, you know, I guess respiratory droplets go down through the mouthpiece and out the keyholes of any instrument, really, or, you know, out the bell of a trombone, you name it. And that's a real concern and is actually just a giant headache and is probably going to prevent, frankly, a lot of the normal resumption of band rehearsals as school year gets underway. Just another wrinkle in this whole thing. But and it really kind of hit home when I saw this woman playing. It was like a cloth bag she had over her clarinet. And I said, well, I hope it doesn't muffle the sound too much. But anyway, there you go. A lot of weird
and
stuff.
Choirs, you know, choirs singing.
Yep, that's another one. I mean, normally you're a lot closer to your choir mates than 6 feet away. That is for sure. And your mouths are wide open, and I don't singing through a mask has got to be quite a challenge, if it's possible at all. I don't know. Yikes.
Right.
Well, so sports and music, and I'm sure some other things we're not even thinking about here, just, you know, classrooms. How do you set up a classroom and keep all the students 6 feet apart? Yikes. Anyway. You know, getting back to school, we're talking about guidelines calling for daily health checks, use of face masks, social distancing when possible, testing strategies. These are all just for athletic activities, but I think these ideas probably apply more broadly there. U.S.-China trade war quietly escalates is another headline on your list. What's going on there, Bob?
Well, you know, Dave, since you and I talked last Friday, there's been a lot that's happened. The Trump administration went after China about Tibet. And of course, that's been an issue since 1959, when the Dalai Lama and 50,000 people were, you know, driven out of there. But all of a sudden, it's refired right now with the Trump administration. Trump administration was going after China and signed a bill for sanctions because of Hong Kong and what China's doing over there. And now they have, you know, just aggressively continued the trade, which was nothing new to us. President Trump campaigned on that. He won states he shouldn't have won, like Pennsylvania, campaigning on that. But it has escalated, and in a sense, quietly, until also yesterday, where Attorney General came out, but not so quiet at the Ford Library when he gave a speech. And he went out against Disney and Google, Yahoo, you know, on and on and on, actually insinuated that possibly the Justice Department would go after them as under the Foreign Registration Act, where if you're lobbying for a foreign country, you've got to register. He sort of insinuated Disney and some other big corporate giants are basically doing the will of Beijing and they should maybe register as lobbyists. It was kind of a fascinating twist from the AG. I read the whole speech. He really went after people. So I think you're seeing this escalation on China, quietly the tariffs, but not so quietly the Attorney General and Secretary of State. But I think it's also going to fit into the campaign where you're going to see Joe Biden attacked over and over and over about, quote, weak on China is what you're going to see.
Yeah. Boy, and it's just kind of amazing that, I mean, it's sort of a little bit of, would you call it saber rattling or just, I mean, this effort to pick a fight with China so as to distinguish yourself from your political rival at home. Good foreign policy?
Well, Trump has always had this position. I've always actually loved every president. I loved hearing how they were going to go after China until they got elected, and then they didn't do it. I mean, that includes all of them, frankly, Clinton, Bush twice, you know, Obama. But Trump promised to go after China, and he did. You know, he just continued to do it. And I think that in itself is some pretty decent policy to make China, you know, capitulate to us and make things fairer for the American workers. But now some of this is saber rattling. I mean, Tibet's been around for a long, long time. So
yeah.
I think some of that is saber, you know, rattling in itself.
And let me ask you on the trade stuff, is China capitulating?
Well, it for China, this is a hard question for me to answer because I've watched and fought for years. You know, I did press conferences with Bernie Sanders against China. And for me, this is major movement that China's even trying to do a few small things. But in reality, no, it's not capitulating. In reality, it's just doing small movements. For those of us who have been around a long time not being able to get any movement, then we're like, wow, maybe this is encouraging. But in reality, yeah, China hasn't done a whole lot in it. And I think that there has to be, for Biden's campaign committee, they have to be struggling with a question here. You know, because Trump is for something, do they need to be against it? And what I mean by that, because Trump's going after China, I think maybe on the Democratic side in particular, they're going to have to be very careful that they don't say, well, you know, China's okay. I think they've got to be very careful because these days with the virus and China's behavior before the virus, et cetera, there's a lot of Americans, both sides of the aisle, pretty well down on China.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess, you know, one last question, which is just how this idea of getting down on China, getting tough on China or whatever, what kind of results has it achieved so far?
Well, so far, it's made China, again, for the first time in modern history, it's made them begin to talk about doing a trade deal or talk about making some changes, you know. Bernie Sanders' position on China would have been the same, but let's face it, Bernie Sanders' approach might have been different, therefore maybe achieving a little bit more, you know, than President Trump has through total aggression.
Hard to know, yeah. Well, Bob May, appreciate you joining me again this week.
Thank
Let's do it
you.
Again next Friday.
Thank
maybe
you.
We'll get another update. Maybe things will start, some ice will start to crack. You never know. But all right, have a good weekend, and we'll talk
Thank
to you next
you.
Week. Happy to say we are joined by three performing artists based in Vermont. We have singer Sarah Grace, who's graced many musical stages around Vermont in recent years, and has a lovely voice and really good style, and is someone who is getting a more prominent name in the music biz in these parts. Also, Ben Dunham, who's a bass player and producer, and has teamed up with a number of well-known musicians over time. And Luis Guzman is an actor who has performed in many, many well-known movies and television shows. Mr. Guzman happens to live here in Vermont and so is very keenly aware of the performing arts scene in here, in this state, including he's been in some movies that have been made in Vermont, Disappearances, and a couple of other Jay Craven pieces, and does great work. If you saw a picture, we can't show a picture on the radio, but if you saw a picture of Luis Guzman, I'm sure you'd say, I've seen that guy. So the three of you, I really appreciate you joining me this morning. Thank you so much.
For sure. Thanks for having me.
And let me start with you, Sarah, if I could. This is a very weird time for many people in many fields. We've talked with educators about the difficulties of trying to run a classroom virtually, and we've talked with many other people about just the struggles they're having coping with the coronavirus. Boy, performing artists have been kind of just spun and whacked and whatever you want to call it in these months of this pandemic. And tell us, I'm guessing you had a whole bunch of gigs lined up for the spring that just didn't happen.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, a lot of things are canceled. It was pretty devastating. It still is pretty devastating to the live music, you know, industry. And I think a lot of musicians are affected differently, but for me personally, you know, doing these live streams and connecting with other musicians has been a saving grace, because I can't imagine not performing, not playing music, you know, not having anything to look forward to. That would be really hard.
Gotta have music in your life. I know musicians, and I know I've seen that in action in a lot of musicians' lives. They just gotta have it. And so you've actually been able to do some performing virtually, I guess. Is that the best way to describe it?
Yep, that's right. Yep. And then just put in a Venmo link and people can donate, and then that way I've been able to stay afloat a little bit, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, have some income.
People have been, yeah. So, and a lot of people have been really generous in that way. But I still can say, like, I miss performing live so much. It's just such a different. I mean, it's beautiful. It's magic. You know, you're bringing people together in the same space. I mean, there's just nothing quite like that. I mean, sitting in front of your cell phone gets old after a while, but you just got to do it. And I know that people really appreciate that. So,
yeah. And I think people do appreciate the effort of you know, the sort of virtual online performances that have gone on. I actually interviewed a couple of student singers from the Bellows Free Academy up in St. Albans a couple weeks ago about a performance the high school choir did, where, you know, you look at it online on YouTube, and it's basically all these little pictures of individual choir members, and occasionally they show the choir director, and they're all doing this virtually from home. And one question I have for a musician like you, Sarah, is just kind of how do you keep it all together? How does everybody keep the beat and they, you know, enter at the right split second, et cetera?
I'm actually not the one to talk to. I've only done live stream stuff, like just on my own or in the same room with Ben. So in terms of like that kind of technology, I have no idea. I am not that technically savvy, to tell you the truth. Yep. I'm just good at using my hands.
Some song line, I think, said, all this science I don't understand is just my job 5 days a week. Hey, Ben Dunham, you're a music producer, so I'm betting you put people together, right?
Yes, that actually comes pretty easy for most musicians. And typically what we do is we'll send the song, and then there's a backing click track, and that's basically, the technique is called overdubbing. So you're able to do, you know, multiple tracks remotely from all over. And we had some experience with this in the past, working in Puerto Rico and South America and LA and beyond, where you can just stack tracks through through Dropbox. And so what you do is you end up, you know, reamping the signal. So we get a raw signal, and then we implement whatever the taste and the feel, and then we just stack the tracks. So it actually works out pretty well, and it's been a wonderful outlet for all the musicians that we've worked with in the past.
So in the old days, radio guys used to talk about stacks of wax, but now it's stacks of tracks. Okay, we all have to adapt at some point. Luis Guzman, you're obviously in a different performing art, not so much music, but acting, and boy, the movie and TV industry is another one that's been completely thrown for a loop. What have you seen out there?
Well, we're definitely in shutdown mode. What's going on right now is that all these protocols are being laid out. They're being laid out by the Screen Actors Guild, by the Directors Guild, the Producers Guild, because anytime you do a movie or film project, you have to get some kind of insurance bond, you know, in case something happens. And a lot of no one is being insured right now because of this COVID, you know? So
yeah,
they're still trying to figure it out, you know? You know, luckily we have things like doing voiceover work and using your voice for like animated films, because that you can do from home, and that's a little bit of a source of income. But, you know, I've been writing and developing some stuff, but also I've been learning a lot during this COVID situation here. And, you know, people like Ben and Sarah, who I deeply love and support as artists, you know, we will be finding ways to, you know, perform for people, even if it's through Zoom or, you know, a social distancing kind of concert, but because people need it. And again, you know, we have a lot of talent up here, and so we're going to figure it out.
Yeah, it sounds like you're keeping that positive spirit, which is an important thing. And I'm curious to know, it sounds like right now in your world, Luis Guzman, that really there are some business issues that need to be worked out. This insurance stuff you mentioned. What about when we get to production, when actually, you know, maybe these musicians are actually, you know, making recordings and dubbing one track over another and so on. Eventually I would guess if this thing goes on that there may be some people in the film industry who are saying, okay, let's get back to work, and we're just going to figure out a way to sort of stack acting roles on top of each other like musical tracks. I mean, can you picture something like that happening?
I don't picture that happening, because here's the deal. You know, as a producer, you are responsible for a production. And within that production, if you have a crew member or a cast member, and they all of a sudden come up testing positive for COVID, that's one
Yikes.
Thing.
Yeah.
But then if it becomes a grave situation and somebody loses their life, then you are open to a lawsuit and stuff like that, you know? And
yeah,
that's what I'm saying. You know, it's something, it's going to get figured out. I know it's going to get figured out. And, you know, we're going to have to shoot a little different moving forward. You know, I believe it's possible, but again, we got to come up with a plan. You know, and the part of the plan in my industry is you might have people living in an encampment and nobody could come in and nobody could come out.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that
production. And that's a reality. And if, like I said, as an artist, and you want to create art, then you got to be all part of that process.
You got to be creative about the process because it's going to change in these circumstances. Hey, Luis Guzman, Sarah Grace, and Ben Dunham, I've got to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS news here, but we can continue this conversation on the other side. I hope you'll all stay with me for a couple minutes of news here, and we'll be back very shortly here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. Don't forget, folks, 11 o'clock or there, shortly thereafter, we go live to a news conference with Governor Phil Scott, other top state officials talking about the COVID-19 response. So don't touch that dial at 11 o'clock. You'll hear the governor's and other top state officials' news conference. Back shortly.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Darn, I thought I might have something really cool to offer up to our listeners this morning, but Sarah Grace is out with a new tune, or soon to be out with a new tune. I guess it hasn't been released yet, so we can't offer it up for you this morning. It's called, Sarah, tell us about it, this smokescreen song that you have produced.
Yeah, actually, so it's, the song was written by Ben Dunham and also produced by Ben Dunham, and mm-hmm. I sung the lead vocals and did some guitar work, and we have, it includes some really awesome, amazing Vermont artists, Ray Pachkowski and Russ Lawton of Solomonde, Rob Morse, and Nick Casarino, who's now in New York City, and a lot, and Rob O'Day. It was recorded at Tank Studio in Burlington, and and Ben and I worked on it. It's going to be released on August 1st, and we're really excited about it.
I actually sampled it last night, and I'll say it's very well done. It's a very cool tune, and I bet you'll definitely get some airtime, and it'll be a good thing for you, I'm sure, because you deserve to have that happen. And you had to put all this together in these pandemic conditions, right?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, the last of it, it started to get recorded before the pandemic, but to put the finishing touches on, that's right. And then a lot of it, so Nick Casarino was able to record his guitar part from New York City and you know, overdub and stuff like that. So not entirely, but the finishing touches, yeah.
I see, okay.
Yeah, you should know that Sarah is an incredible, incredible gifted artist. And every time I see her play and I see her sing, you know, she just lights up that whole room, that whole space and stuff. And she's a real gift to Vermont. She really is.
Yeah, that.
I absolutely admire her.
That's quite a tribute. And I like this smokescreen tune, I got to tell you. And Sarah Grace is one of my guests this morning. She's the lead singer on the tune. Ben Dunham, producer. Ben, did you play bass on this cut?
Actually, Rob Morse from Hadestown played bass on that track.
Oh, okay.
And he did an amazing job. Yep.
Speaking of Hadestown.
Yep.
Speaking of Hadestown, which of course has been a huge award-winning production, Anais Mitchell, another Vermonter, produced that. Sarah, you were, that's what, among your credits, correct?
So when she was first writing it, 14 some years ago, I think it was 2006 and 2007. It could have been 2007, 2008. I'm not sure. It was so long ago. I played the character Cerberus, and we toured around. We did it for 2 years, and we toured around Vermont. We did a show in Massachusetts, it was so much fun. And the song that I got to sing was Why We Build the Wall, which is a pretty epic tune. And I had so much fun with that. I guess the new version, I haven't seen the new version yet. I have yet to. Actually, I had a ticket for April, and or I was going to get a ticket, and then the COVID hit. So hopefully, you know, next year it'll go be back on. But such an incredible piece
back
of
around.
Music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Why the tune was Why We Build the Wall?
That's right. Yep.
Was that the tune you Does it give us any messages about any current wall building efforts we might know of?
Well, yeah, I mean, basically it's a song about, well, it's many, many things, but you know, she wrote that song like 14 years ago, and when Trump got in office, I mean, it definitely got a lot of attention, but she just happened to write it a decade before all this talk of building a wall. And I mean, it's about, you know, the war, it's about a war on poverty, basically. It's a war on poor people, you know, and that's going on, you know, that's happening, it's real. So,
yeah,
it's been going on for quite a while.
Kind of come to a head in recent years, maybe, or just been more front and center in a lot of people's consciousness. Of course, with all the talk from our president about building a wall, certainly that is worth going back and checking that tune out to see what's there for any thoughts that might be generated about this wall and other walls. Certainly, Ben Dunham, I'm wondering, you know, let's go back to the discussion we were having about just the technical aspects of producing music in a pandemic. And I'm wondering, have you actually had to deal at all with people who, you know, were maybe in the middle of a project or whatever and then suddenly got sick?
You know, I don't know anybody that I've been involved with that has gotten sick. I do know that there have been numerous projects put on hold right now, and there's going to be follow-ups. And in some ways, it's, you know, we just have to focus on, you know, what's going on inside each one of us and taking care of our family and our friends and taking the downtime to really just be introspective and involved in, you know, the creative process. It's a downtime, and we need to make the best of it.
Yeah, and Luis Guzman, you said a few minutes ago that you've been doing some writing during this time, you know, kind of downtime, I guess you might call it. And I'm wondering, are we thinking screenplays or are these TV shows? Are they movies? What have you been working on?
I'm writing comedy because I like doing stand-up.
Huh.
I'm working at producing a Louis Guzman cooking show from Vermont. I can do it in my kitchen. Yeah, I know Sarah's going to come by. I'm going to need a taste tester. And
Sarah's a taste tester?
Like I say, you know, just still in the loop of putting some things together. I do have a couple of scripts. I do have the rights to a couple of books and stuff, you know. And like I said, I'm just waiting it out, you know. I'm just waiting it out and seeing what the best way to proceed. But in the meantime, like I said, just living life here in Vermont and gardening and growing food and, you know, when I can, see my friends, you know, and you know, it's still living, man. Still kicking.
Wow. Yeah, that's what you got to do is just still be kicking. Now, in terms of the food show that you're talking about, do you focus mainly on, you know, cuisine of your native Puerto Rico, or are you doing, you know, dishes with maple syrup as an ingredient? Or What kind of food do you focus on?
Anything that's edible.
That's a pretty broad range.
I'll even cook for aliens, man. If they land on my lawn, I'll invite them in. I just cooked up this dish. Check it out. Let me know what you think.
I've heard the little green creatures like green vegetables, so that could be a thing.
That's kind of stereotyping them. That's not what I heard.
Oh, really?
Help
me out here.
I heard they like oatmeal. With almond milk and a little bit of maple syrup on there.
Oatmeal with almond milk and
maple syrup. So, I mean, look, man, I cook Puerto Rican food. I cook Italian. I cook anything that's American cuisine. I make great salads. I make, you know, and basically, look, the show that I want to do is just like I'm not there to be Chef Ramsay or you know, any or Bobby Flay or any of those guys. I'm there to be like a layman cook, just to show people, hey man, this is a better way to keep ourselves healthy during these times. You know, the easiest thing in the world to make is bread. And people don't realize that. Four ingredients: yeast, flour, salt, and water. And that's it.
And you can I'll tell you something.
In the world.
You'll be glad to hear this. I actually had a segment on the Dave Graham Show a few weeks ago where I had somebody on from King Arthur Flour and a couple of sourdough bread bakers, and they were talking to me about how there's been an absolute boom in sourdough bread baking in Vermont in recent times, especially during the pandemic when people, you know, are home with time on their hands and they're starting to get their starters going and they're making a lot of bread. And so it was a fascinating discussion actually with some people who are really passionate about, and it got a rise out of some listeners too. So that was good. Sorry, bad pun there. I had to slice that one in there. I really appreciate Luis Guzman, your approach to food. It sounds quite eclectic, and I want to ask you about this is a weird analogy that has just occurred to me a couple times, and I figured while you're talking about this, I'll go ahead and put the thought out there and see what you think about it. There are a lot of divisions in the world between nationalities and between religions and et cetera. People figure out all sorts of ways to kind of set up barriers between different groups of people. Food, it seems to me, is a realm in which those barriers come down really, really easily. You know, you have people who are mixing, I don't know, Taiwanese and Mexican and, you know, Indian and French and whatever cuisines from around the world and coming up with some really brilliant stuff. And why can't other aspects of life follow that example?
Oh man, that's the ultimate question, man. You know what it is, man. I think people need to do a better job of studying history. You know, because there's so much that history can teach us, and why we have these conflicts and stuff. And you know, it's hard, man. You know, I mean, I wish we could live in the world that it was harmonious. Stuff, you know, but you know, like in this country when they had the Mexican-American War, little do people know the history that 18,000 Mexicans were hung in Texas. You know, and so, I mean, there's like so much stuff. You know, yes, food does bring us all together. You know, my belief is that world peace begins at home. You know, world
sure.
belief begins at home. And you know, I mean, you know, it's like people have died over more religious conflicts than anything in the world. You know? And that's pretty sad. That's a bad statement on religion.
Sarah and Ben, here's a challenge for you. You got to write a song about how, you know, barriers are just disappear or knocked down really easily with food, and maybe other stuff should follow. That would be a,
yeah,
I think that would
yeah,
be a,
I agree.
Interesting little idea.
You know. What they sing the song.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Wait, say again, Luis.
Just tell me it.
I'll be cooking on stage while they sing and perform the song.
Oh, now we got a whole thing going here. Major performance art here. That's awesome, and with some food resulting from it. What more can you ask for? That's pretty. We're already cooking it up here.
I just want to say that, like I say, you know, as far as Ben Dunham goes, and Sarah, you know, they do an incredible job again of bringing many different artists together to perform together, to perform out there for the community. You know, they are a lifeline to many people. With their songs, with the messages in their songs. And I'm always grateful to them, and not only myself, but I'm sure many members of our community. And I would encourage them, keep doing your thing. Keep doing your thing, because you have no ceiling. Sky's the limit. You know, you can go as far as you want to go. And, you know, I believe in you because you believe in yourself, you know, and I praise you guys, you know, because you deserve it. So, yeah.
Thanks, Louie.
Thanks, Louie.
That's
Dave, I just met you, so the jury's still out, okay? Yeah.
Well, you can any day you feel like it, between 9:05 and 11 a.m., you can tune in to WDEV in Waterbury, and you can hear what we're doing here and see if you like it. I'm always curious for new listeners. I'm eager for new listeners and curious about feedback from folks. You know, I still consider myself a bit of a rookie at this stuff. I was a longtime word guy at the Associated Press Bureau here in Vermont, and just got into radio about 2.5 years ago, and so I'm still learning, and it's been fun so far, and we hope it'll continue to be for a while yet. But you know, as I say, any coaching anybody, especially you performers out there, if you want to call me up and say, Dave, way too many pauses in your speech, or too many ums and ahs, or whatever. I don't mind a little nudge here and there for trying to.
Dave.
Yeah.
Dave, we don't live in a perfect world. Don't sweat.
All right.
Ums and pauses are okay, because it just shows you're processing. Okay. Put a positive spin on it. You're processing.
I'm processing.
There you go. I got you.
Yeah,
don't sweat it.
All right.
Next person. Dave.
Okay. Thank you. Next person who tells me I've got too many ums and ahs there, I'll just say, you ever heard your computer whir? You know, like when you put in a command and it goes or whatever. You see that ball spinning? that's what I'm doing. Just don't worry about it. It's a little auditory signal there or something. So, I do want to actually focus the conversation here a little bit more on the performing arts here, because, Sarah, what's the horizon look like? I mean, I guess, you know, people talk about, are they going to develop a vaccine? Are we going to finally get out? Is that the day when you're going to say, my life starts to get back to normal, or is there a way to build some kind of normal before then, or what do you think?
I'm not really into normalcy, and I know that everything is uncertain, and it was uncertain before this COVID thing. So I think the norm is just thinking that everything is like, you know, this is what we do and this is what I'm doing. But the fact is that curveballs happen all the time, knock people down, pull the rug out from under them. And that's part of growing and evolving and learning. I mean, as far as, like, I have no idea. And honestly, I feel like they say different things every day about this virus, and it's hard to know what is true and what's not. But I think ultimately taking care of yourself, eating oatmeal for breakfast. Taking care of yourself is like, that's how you're going to keep yourself healthy and staying connected with people. I mean, that's, you were talking about bread and food, bringing people together and, you know, permeating walls and boundaries and divisions. I feel like music is the same, is like the same thing. You know, music can like just hop over any wall. In fact, just bust it down, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's just focusing on,
That's a very cool way to think about it. I think you're definitely onto something there. Luis Guzman, what do you think? What does your horizon look like?
You know what? I just live in day by day, and figuring out what this universe has in store for us. You know. Because look, I feel what's going on right now, it's out of our hands. It really is. This is Mother Nature hitting a reset button on humanity. And we need to look at it that way, you know, because this is real, man. This is like, you know, the next pandemic, we might not be so lucky. You know, right now I don't think we're lucky, but I just feel that, like I said, right now, day by day and, you know, the horizon, it's always going to be there.
Yeah.
You just got to be willing to meet up with it, you know?
Well, that's the thing, for sure. Hey, Luis Guzman and Sarah Grace and Ben Dunham have been my guests this last 45 minutes or so. The three of you, I really appreciate you joining me this morning. It's been a fun discussion and very thoughtful, and your inputs have been excellent. So thank you so much. We're about out of time. Heading to the end of the Dave Graham Show on this Friday. And stay tuned, though, to WDEV for the governor's news conference. Governor and other top state officials, that is, talking about the COVID-19 response. And we will be back Monday with another edition of our program. And stay healthy out there, everybody. Do what you need to do. Remember the masks and the hand washing and all of that stuff. And have a good weekend. We'll talk to you Monday.